already something. And they would sing along with me. We'd be so happy as can be. Cause down below is really nowhere. And if my name were Juniper, and I would know where I was going, and then I would become all knowing. My beard's over everyone's clothing. If I became deaf, dumb, and blind, because I pity all mankind, and broke my heart to make things right, I'd know that every single night. When my angelic work was through, the angels and the devil too would sing my childhood song to me about the time they called me Black Dog. If I could be for only an hour, if I could be for an hour every day, if I could be for just one little hour, a cute coat in a stupid ass
way. Number 21. concussion. Turn it upside down. Got to hear percussion. Got to hear percussion.
Number 27, Peter Cook, Bedazzled, which is something I sung with the Hoof and Mouth Symphonia back in around 2002. At 26, we heard Fetus with Warm Leatherette. 25, we heard Weekend with Summer Days, which I heard first on Bob Brannan's show, I think. Number 24, Ella Rheingold with Giant Steps, the Bee Gees. 23, Neil Cicierega with Ribs, one of my favourite mashups. Number 22, something new from Blectum from Blectum, Jackie. And then at 21, Memorabilia, Non-Stop Ecstatic Dancing Version by Soft Cell. Join us next week for the last of the season with a top 20 countdown. You have been listening to Do or DIY with People Like Us, and this is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org.
August the 10th, 1926, a Stinson Detroiter SM-16C monoplane took off from the rudimentary Estes Rip at Tallulah, Louisiana. The Detroiter was the first airplane built with an eclectic starter motor, wheel, brakes and a heated cabin, but it was not a good climber, so the pilot leveled off quickly, circled the airstrip and surrounding landscape, held open the specifically fitted sticky trap beneath the planned swing for the designated 10 minutes, and soon returned to land. As he touched down, P.A. Glick and his colleagues at the Division of Cotton Insect Investigations of the U.S. Bureau of Entomology and Plant Quarantine ran out to meet him. It was a historic flight, the first attempt to collect insects by airplane. Glick and his associated as well as researchers at the Department of Agriculture and at regional organizations such as the New York State Museum were trying to discover the migration secrets of gypsy moths, cotton boll moths, and other insects that were munching their way through the nation's natural resources. They wanted to predict infestations, to know what might happen next. How could they contain these insect enemies if they didn't know and when and how they...
Did you find insects to be obsessive?
Yeah, completely. You mean like...
Is there an obsessive quality to them?
Yeah. I mean, what, like are insects themselves obsessive or do people who... Or do they like create obsessiveness?
Well, actually, both. Both.
Yeah. Insects are pretty focused, I always found, generally. You know, like a lot of animals feel like, well, see, it's hard because generally, yeah, and as soon as I said that, I thought of like the counterexample. And I think that basically people don't know very much about insects, which is one of the things that made it really interesting to study them. insect science, well, an awful lot of insect science is funded by the military, which means that the basic science, which means that it's really, really directed. It's really instrumental. They're looking for specific things.
Hello, I'm Adrian. You're listening to The Blind Tourist on WFMU. This is an hour with author and anthropologist Hugh Raffles. I'm following his insight through the strangely human world of insects in his book Insectopedia. Small, very detailed spaces. To follow along with the episode, visit WFMU.org and find The Blind Tourist and this hour with Hugh Raffles.
You know, insects seem like they're very, very focused, but actually, you know, we don't know very much about them and about how most of the research is in this very applied way.
Ideas take different shapes in the way that you write and in the way that you learn something. More specifically, with Insectopedia, I think because you're not an entomologist. I mean, you're really looking at people and their relationship to insects. Like, here's how different individuals interact with them. Here's how we feel about them in the world. Here's how they function in the world. Here's how they're all around us. The air chapter is like such a good example of this as well.
You know, sometimes I think the book was sort of a failure because what I wanted to do really was try to figure out how to think about insects as insects. I was really interested in trying to see, well, you know, if you think about these philosophically, or if you think about them through literature or poetry, or if you think about them through the social sciences, or if you think about them through natural sciences or entomology, what kind of knowledge do you get with these different approaches, and what do these animals look like, or these beings look like? And then maybe if you start to put these things together in some way, you'll start to understand what, and I had this idea that you'd start to understand I know something about them, I suppose, but no, actually, I don't think so. I think I understood much more about human knowledge-making practices, really. I don't feel like I really got any closer to insects in that way.
It's just different types of knowledge, exactly. And I don't think one is... one does not replace the other. I think people, you know, you wouldn't have got to the studies of cell structure if there weren't people who were interested enough to just sit and observe the mushroom in the first place.
I think a lot of what I'm doing is like mapping things out, just trying to understand, I don't know, like a landscape or a domain or something, you know, how these things are organized and what they look like better. I try to like put them together and sort of just like write them.
Like really like looking at the way that a flower is, you know, put together, like smelling it, really, like I was just really observing and being mindful. I didn't even know what mindfulness was, but that was the only thing that was available to me.
Looking closely and observing.
You're hearing bark beetles from The Sound of Light in Trees by David Dunn. There's a chapter in Insectopedia called The Sound of Global Warming. It's the W chapter, which talks about Dunn's work.
So he's trying to thinking about complex systems and, you know, complex kinds of model. I mean, he worked with somebody who's interested in modeling complex systems. And then because what he was interested in particularly was changes at a landscape scale.
We're inside a tree, a pinon pine. We're in its vascular tissue, just beneath the outer bark.
But he developed the data to think about that at this real micro level and through thinking about the sonic behavior of insects.
We're enclosed in a rich sound world, a world audible only on David Dunn's CD, The Sound of Light in Trees, the one that's on my headphones. The tree we're inside could be 30 feet tall. That's big if you're tiny, no larger than a grain of rice, like the pinon engraver beetles that arrive by the thousands to lay their eggs and hatch their larvae in these tough, slow-growing trees, which their much-loved seeds and aromatic...
And part of what was so insightful there is that the dominant paradigm for thinking about beetles, particularly at that moment, and still probably, was chemical ecology and looking for chemical traces. He just pretty much ignored that. And instead of looking at pheromones and other kinds of chemicals that insects use to attract or repel each other, and instead of that, he was recording and tracking sound. And through doing that, he just uncovered this completely different set of relationships. You know, many of the sounds were, you know, the particular sounds that, for instance, you know, trees would make under stress, that then the insects could tune into as cues that would then, you know, change
Listen.
Their behavior in relation to those cues.
They're coming through loud and clear. Those squeaky chirps are the pinon engraver beetles. The female has a small, hard comb on the back of her head, which she grates against a scrape located under the front edge of her prothrax. The male makes sounds too, but no one is sure how. But more than just the sound of life in trees, the soundscape is the soundtrack to an epidemic. These nosy beetles are not merely symptoms of global warming, says Dunn and Crutchfield. They are also its cause. Dunn and Crutchfield see forest dynamics as a cybernetic feedback loop accelerating under conditions of climate change. With their relentless successful adaptive population dynamics, the insects drive the system past equilibrium. Decisive in clearing the forest, and so releasing carbon stored in tree biomass and capturing...
Where did
trees.
It go, though? No, look, I mean, honestly... I should be used to this. I lived in a house that was infested with cockroaches, but apparently, oh my god, I think everything I'm stepping on is a cockroach.
People often really pay attention to them mostly when they get in the way.
Don't laugh at me, okay? You would do the same thing. Okay. Either, oh my god, where the is it? No, I'm sorry for all the swearing. Okay, we're gonna go. Oh my god.
I think it's interesting that when you asked if I have any feelings about them, that I immediately describe them in terms of threat or not. Why should I? Could they not be described in joyous terms? Insects are wonderful. I think that they're just often out of sight. I don't think about insects all that much.
The danger, like, doesn't really come from a big animal, something like that. Actually, in fact, what can be really dangerous is like little caterpillars.
I grew up in Florida. When I was growing up, there were always cockroaches in the cereal box. And it was this thing where every morning I always just remember you get the cereal box out and you'd shake it and listen to see if anything moves after you've shaken it. And it's just this like very, very specific memory I always have with cockroaches. To this day, if I have cereal, my impulse is to shake the box, even though I've been a cockroach in my cereal probably since I was like 12. Anyway, I thought if you have any sort of anecdotes.
You know, I do, but I wish I'd known that one. That would have gone in my nightmares chapter for sure. I thought of that. It's really good. You know, I first came to New York in 1984, and I kind of, you know, I sort of moved from sublet to sublet, and then I remember like running out of sublets. I lived in the East Village, but there was a period when I couldn't find anywhere to live, but I was working in restaurants, so I had some income. And for a while, I stayed in this hotel that doesn't exist anymore called the Carlton Arms Hotel, which is on the 24th and Lex, maybe? Anyway. And it was really, really cheap. And I remember really clearly every night when I came home after work, I would go into the room and turn the light on by the door, and the floor would scatter. And it would just scatter, just like all the roaches, and you turn the lights on, they would just go. And then, you know, they would come back during the evening. That's an insect memory that I have.
There is the nightmare of swarming and nightmare of crawling.
Scatter.
There is the nightmare of burrowing and the nightmare of being seen in the dark. There is the nightmare of turning the overhead light on just as the carpet scatters. There is the nightmare of being without reason and the nightmare of being unable to communicate. There is the nightmare of their being out to get us. There is the nightmare of knowing and the nightmare of non-recognition. There is the nightmare of not seeing the face. There is the nightmare of not having a face. There is the nightmare of too many limbs.
Sometimes we're going to enter. The plan is I'm going to take this broom and I'm going to. I don't even know what the plan is. So I'm going to take the broom and I'm going to hit this. And I'm going to see if it'll fly out. And I'm really nervous. Oh god. It might be under there. I don't know. Okay, that just makes everything worse. Because if it's not under there, then I really don't want to.
There is something in there. Looks like it has legs. It's weird. I don't know. Absolutely. 100%. What I'm gonna do is put this.
There is the nightmare of the military that funds nearly all basic research into insect science. The nightmare of probes into brains and razors into eyes. The nightmare that should any of this reveal the secrets of locust swarming, of bees navigating, or of ants foraging. The secrets will beget other secrets. The nightmares are the nightmares. The pupae are the pupae. Insects born of microimplants. Part machine, part insects. Remote controlled weaponized surveillance.
An awful lot of insect science is funded by the military. The basic science, you know, which means that it's really, really directed. It's really instrumental. They're looking for specific things. They're really looking to see what they can learn from, like, flight vision, that that can be translated into, right now it's probably like self-guided planes, I don't know, but into fighter jets, so that, you know, moving really, really fast, but also being able to, and you know, I'm not great on this because I wasn't that interested in military applications, so I didn't spend a lot of time on that, but it struck me over and over again, I read these papers, and when you got down to the funding at the end of them, these academic papers, the funding was nearly always from some military funding agency of some kind, or a lot of the sort of like the really, I guess, creative, but sort of speculative insect research, like creating tiny insect-based robots and stuff like that, came from DARPA, which is the research arm of the military.
Because we're fighting a total war, our forces must be marshaled against every enemy, unseen as well as seen, in every place, all of the time. Millions of insects constitute an important part of our foes. In their way, as militant as the action. Their menace multiplies as they multiply. Because in some areas, more men were being incapacitated from action by insect-borne diseases.
People have written histories of, for instance, the development of the relationship between the development of insecticides and chemical weapons. Because they've been very tight, together, so that, you know, even the, you know, Zyklon B that was used in the Holocaust in concentration camps was initially an insecticide, and that's not, it's not unique. There were other gases that were developed in the field. A lot of that work came out of the First World War, when people started to, you know, when there was the application of these gases in the trenches. So people have written histories about that kind of thing. I think not much, but a certain amount of what you find in that area of trying to think about relationships between people and insects would be around those sort of questions. Not all of it, so it's all of it, but some of it.
The Amazon River. And look at these butterflies. Oh my gosh, they're just swarming everywhere.
An awful lot of insect science is funded by the military, which means that it's really, really directed. They're looking for specific things.
If we want to build a robot that can do this, look at nature and say, okay, animals are already really good at doing this, particularly insects. Why don't we figure out how insects work and then build a robot?
Flight vision.
How do we get
that can be translated into fighter jets?
Butterflies are landing on me.
You know, moving really, really fast, but also being able to, and you know, I'm not great on this because I wasn't that interested in military applications, so I didn't spend a lot of time on that. But it struck me over and over again, I read these papers, and when you got down to the funding at the end of them, these academic papers, the funding was nearly always from some military funding agency of some kind or another. Or a lot of the sort of like the really, I guess, creative, but sort of speculative insect research, like creating tiny insect-based robots and stuff like that, came from DARPA, which is the research arm of the military. Seem obsessive when you see them. They seem like they're incredibly focused on doing the stuff that they're doing, getting their food, or but I often think that if we actually really knew what they're up to, then they're not probably not like that at all. You know, they're probably as scattered as we all are, probably, and need downtime and like distraction time as much as we do and all that kind of stuff. I like to think about them like that.
Insects are wonderful.
My strategy shifted and I started trying to find people who were obsessed with insects and so had thought about this for a lot longer than me and might have more to say about it.
Insects are all around us. They produce many sounds at many frequencies and volume levels. We are so accustomed to hearing insect sounds that we seldom listen to them. Crickets produce their chirps by rubbing their wings together. Rough spots on the cricket's wings produce the chirping vibrations which we hear. The cricket is highly sensitive to temperature. In fact, we can tell the temperature by crickets. Count the number of chirps in 15 seconds and add 40. The result is very close to the temperature on the Fahrenheit thermometer. Listen.
Money Mark, Insects Are All Around Us, heading into Vashti Bunyan, Timothy Grubb. It's the Blind Taurus on WFMU. We're listening to an hour with Hugh Raffles on his book Insectopedia.
That cricket was chirping at 76 degrees Fahrenheit.
Straw.
were trying to find people who were obsessed with insects and so had thought about this for a lot longer than me and might have more to say about it.
Like Kuo-chan, Yuro has loved insects since he was a child. Like Kuo-chan, he told us that they affected him profoundly. After collecting for so many years, he now has mushy eyes, bug eyes, and sees everything in nature from an insect's point of view. Each tree is its own world. Each leaf is different. Insects taught him that general nouns like insects, trees, leaves, and especially nature destroy out sensitivity to detail. They make us conceptually as well as physically violent. Oh, an insect. We say, seeing only the category, not the being itself.
In research, you really only get answers to the questions that you ask. Creating tiny insect-based robots, you really only get answers to the questions that you ask. Questions that you ask. That's why the book is full of people like that, one way or another. There's a lot of people like that who really have thought a long time and have these close relationships of different kinds with insects. Some people feel like they can communicate with them. Some people feel like they just really understand what an insect is doing or feeling, or you know, why it's doing things, you know, why it's doing things. Some people feel like they just really understand what an insect is doing or feeling, or you know, why it's doing things, you know, why it's doing things. Often, not always, I mean, it really depends on the person, but and on the intensity of the fieldwork, but often people start to see things in ways very differently from the way they did before. And then get really, really interested in that as well, because in a way it gives them an opportunity to see the city differently, see things that they could be doing or places.
We're starting
that they could
to go hear Adventures of the Solitary Bird by Mia Masayoka.
Then they really start to drive it as well. Once you really get in sync with somebody and start really working together in that way, and they'll be talking to people about it as well, who'll be suggesting things. So some of the best fieldwork that I've done have come from, you know, people I've known or people I've been working to, talking to people who've then said, oh, you have to go, and you know, you got to tell them to go and meet so-and-so. And I'll think, oh, really, has that made sense? And then we'll go and meet them, and of course it makes sense. You know, that person's got all these things to say. And those people were all people who were really had developed their skills through close observation.
Like really like looking at the way that a flower is, you know, put together, like smelling it. And so that became my reading, really. I was just really observing and being mindful. I didn't even know what mindfulness was, but that was the only thing that was available to me.
I think her, in a way, her method came to be the one which I ended up, I think, respecting the most in a sort of natural history tradition of science, which has been very, very sidelined over the last 100 years, I suppose, or sort of non-professionalized. Well, professional science is all about sort of a molecular approach to science, I think. And those people were all people who really had developed their skills through close observation. Talking to, you know, scientists who are very tied up in contemporary methodologies, the work that they were most committed to was very much in their daily life through close observation of living animals. Is often what they're really, really interested in. Or that was what I...
Was this something... Yeah. Were you surprised by this?
Sort of reassuring in a way, I think. I actually really like that this natural history tradition, I guess, is still there because it's a more sort of holistic ecological sense of what science is as well. You know, you're thinking about animals in their context, you're thinking about their relationships with other beings, you're thinking about their sort of like multiple capacities. In research, you really only get answers to the questions that you ask. So if you don't ask questions that are animal-centered, you're not going to get questions that tell you anything about animals. You're only going to get questions. So, like, for instance, if you assume that animals are basically whatever animals it might be, you know, it could be chimps. But if you assume that they are, you know, of lesser capacity than humans, and you test to see whether or not they have, I don't know, the capacity of a 2-year-old child, then that's all you're going to find out, and it's not really going to tell you anything beyond that. And over you see that's what animal research is, you know, is like. It asks questions that assume a diminished capacity, even if they're working as, you know, as much of that research is, even if researchers are working to try to establish, you know, these very, very human categories like consciousness and intelligence and these sort of things, and demonstrate in a way that appears to be, you know, sort of like valorizing an animal, that, you know, an animal has consciousness, which just seems like such a bizarre thing to want to demonstrate. But anyway, or even to assume that an animal wouldn't do. But I guess it's in relation to like hundreds of years of, you know, Western philosophy, which assumes that animals don't.
What insects love rock music?
Answer.
Termites.
I think this, that every time you read one of these articles somewhere, it always says, well, the application of this is that, you know, we are going to find something out about human side, or we're going to be able to, you know, it's going to help us cure this disease or whatever. I think that's really, really tied to funding, basically. I mean, that's how you justify funding. And it's the structure of funding agencies and grant writing and all this sort of thing. So even if the people involved might not be thinking of their research in that way, they're forced into that track because that's the only way you can get money. There's very little money for, you know, basic research that doesn't have human application. Everything is sort of, you know, everything is instrumentalized in terms of its outcomes. And it's a real problem if that's not the way that you want to think, or, you know, you have a different idea of what, I don't know, what knowledge might be. I think it's a real problem.
This is the law of life.
bees actually aren't probably not industrious at all. When they're just basically hanging out.
This is a law of life.
You know, like in the hive, in the dark, and just sort of like hanging out.
چشم سوخته زندگیم با تو رفته.
I chose the project partly but well maybe largely because I didn't know anything about insects, which just seemed absurd, you know, like to live your life and not really these like all this stuff out there, not, you know, these animals, like so many and so important, not know anything about them. But one thing I hadn't really thought about was that so much of it is, you know, is about adjusting your mode of attention and concentration. And I figured this out really from talking to people who'd spent a lot of time with insects and who were really interested in them, that so much of it is just, is really looking closely and observing. And then in doing that, you start to be able to really see these differences that aren't visible to you otherwise, like differences between individual insects and these sort of behavior and stuff like that, which only become really, really apparent when you're really, 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 really focused. And that gets you into this very different sort of psychic space. It's very like you're sort of present in this different, I don't know how to explain it. A little bit like kind of meditative, you know? You're like just in this different sort of zone. And so reality changes. And I think this probably applies to all kinds of very, very small things that people really pay attention to, not just insects, but you know, it was insects that I was really interested in. That so much of it is really looking closely and observing, and then in doing that, you start to be able to really see these differences that aren't visible to you otherwise, like differences between individual insects and these sort of behavior and stuff like that, which only become really, really apparent when you're really, 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 really focused. And that gets you into this very different sort of psychic space, you know? And I think this probably applies to all kinds of very, very small things that people really pay attention to, not just insects, but you know, it was insects that I was really interested in. It's very like you're sort of present in this different, I don't know how to explain it. I mean, a little bit like kind of meditative, you know? You're like just in this different sort of zone. And so reality changes. It's very like you're sort of present in this different, I don't know how to explain it. I mean, a little bit like kind of meditative, you know? You're like just in this different sort of zone. And so reality changes.
Yeah, man.
Where you been so long, man?
Oh, man, I've been out there at 1919 West Taylor.
What you been doing out there, man?
Oh, man, I was out there messing around with Rand and Dr. Newhow, man. I had to get rid of them two bugs and that roach I had.
How you do that?
Oh, man, I hit it something like this, Jack. And that bug is sold, too.
Well, let me see you get a little funky with it now.
Okay, baby. This is where I got rid of that bug. That book.
Man, that's what I'm saying, so. You know, if I had that kind of bug, I'd hate to cut it loose, man.
Do you know what kind of bug that was, man?
What kind of bug was it?
That's that thing they call a TB bug.
Boy,
he was a monster.
Another kind of bug, you should not be in it at all.
That's right, baby. I think we got rid of him, though.
Breeds and hybrids of silkworm. Silkworm breeds and hybrids play a prominent role in deciding silk output and quality. The goal of silkworm breeding is to attain maximum productivity in yield and quality, which is achieved by bringing genetic improvement through combination of desired genes by crossing two selected pure stocks of silkworm, followed by selection. Silkworm breeding was initiated only in 1920s. Till 1950s, polyvoltaic culture prevailed and indigenous polyvoltaic breeds like pure Mysore and C. Nietzsche in South
Africa. When I would talk to people who are like collectors, people would often talk about that. Just the level of attention that was required and focus to really get close to these animals, just sort of made them enter into this different psychic space. Yoru Takeshi talked about that a lot, and he collected weevils, and had a huge collection of weevils, which are very, very, very small. And he really talked about that, and how what he'd learned from doing that was to experience the world like an insect. So this whole idea that you would sort of shift scale and shift perspective, and so that these sort of hierarchies of being really sort of shift as well. Like you stop being the human person who has all these capacitors, and the insect is just like this instinctual being that doesn't really able to do anything, you know, and just sort of just reacts to things. That all breaks down as well with the shift in scale as well. That everything becomes much more equal, you know, and you start to see their capacitors, and your capacitors start getting diminished as well in relation to that. Yeah. When you think of bees as so industrious, but there's this really large amount of time when bees actually aren't, probably not industrious at all, when they're just basically hanging out, you know, like in the hive, in the dark, and just sort of like hanging out. So insects seem obsessive when you see them. They seem like they're incredibly focused on doing the stuff that they're doing, getting their food, but I often think that if we actually really knew what they were up to, then they're not, probably not like that at all. You know, they're probably as scattered as we all are, probably. And need downtime and, like, distraction time as much as we do and all that kind of stuff. I like to think about them like that.
Recent research suggests that insects sleep, or at least like most other creatures, do go through regular periods of rest and inactivity, during which their responses to external stimuli are greatly reduced. It would have been helpful if we'd known how to coordinate our visit to the beach with the flies and activity, but that just wasn't possible. The sleep research doesn't investigate whether insects dream. That's a little too speculative for biologists right now. Perhaps the methodology isn't obvious. But what if they
come
do?
Back to the sound of
what do they dream of?
David Dunn.
Yet more unanswerable questions.
We're nearing the end of the hour. I've been talking to Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia. He actually had another book come out last year, The Book of Unconformity, Speculations on Lost Time, which is not about insects, but it's certainly worth reading, looking up. We've heard all kinds of different things this hour. A lot of Jana Windren, the listener, Earl Hooker, Two Bugs and a Roach, Farah, Law of Life, Call of Cicada, some music from the film Woman in the Dunes. If you want to know what you heard, you can visit The Blind Tourist on WFMU.org, find today's episode on Hugh Raffles. If you're listening as a podcast, you can sort of scroll down to the description and there should be a pretty detailed list of everything there as well. Know what it means to get closer to insects, and I'm not sure if I got closer to them either, but trying to listen to things small, kind of get into these really specific details is nice. It's a different way of...
You know, if you think about these philosophically, or if you think about them through literature or poetry...
If you haven't read Encyclopedia, it's worth it.
Social sciences,
it's what this whole hour's been about.
Natural sciences.
Thanks for listening. I'm Adrian.
What animals
Blind
do you get
from WFMU, East Orange, WMFU,
so
Mount Hope,
like,
in New York City and Rockland County
like,
at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org.
Put these things together in some way, you'll start to understand what... I had this idea that you'd start to understand what they would... what. I know something about them, I suppose, but no, actually, I don't think so. I think I understood much more about human knowledge-making practices, really. I don't feel like I got any closer to insects in that way.
Chosen, but now I'm free.